May the meditations of my mind and the words from my lips be pleasing in your sight. Amen. First, I will bring greetings from St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Greensboro, North Carolina, where the Reverend Jenny Baines Inman is rector and the Reverend Pamela Haynes serves as deacon. I was greatly honored to accept the invitation from the very Reverend Bernard B.J. Owens to provide the sermon today. Reverend Owens was my first rector within the Episcopal Church, and I will apologize to you all in advance for any errors I might make in my theology, despite the excellent examples of well-prepared sermons I witnessed from him. Now, while I am a scholar, I am not an ordained minister. But I will begin my discussion today in the Gospel of Matthew, verse 22, 34 through 40. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question: "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like this: love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these commandments." Now, it is the second commandment that we as Christians seem to fall short. We think that we can love God, but our neighbors not so much. The problem often resides in our collective failure to understand who are our neighbors. Is your neighbor limited to those who look like you or share the same recent genetic ancestry with you? Evidence that this is how the majority of Christians in the United States operate today is shown by the fact that Sunday morning is still the most racially segregated time of the week. American Christianity has still not solved its race problem, in part because it does not understand what race is. The rest of our society doesn't understand this either. This is why I've spent so much of my academic time attempting to help us better understand the origins of race and racism. Now, it may surprise some of you that biology in the Western world began as an extension of Christian theology. In the 18th century, the examination of nature was actually called natural theology. Many clergy engaged in the collection and classification of animals and plants. The quality of these observations were astonishing and enduring. Besides speculating about the variety of beetles they discovered, naturalists of this time period also questioned the origin of non-European people. The most popular theory at this time was monogenism with degeneracy, in which Europeans were seen as the least degenerated and Africans the most degenerated of human races. The monogenism held that there had been one special creation of humans, Adam and Eve, and that their progeny had spread across the earth. Specifically, it held that all living people were the descendants of the sons of Noah who had survived the great flood. Medieval scholars had no consensus concerning which populations were descended from which son. It was generally agreed that the people of Israel descended from Shem, but there was no agreement about who were the descendants of Japheth and Ham. However, during the 3rd century CE, the myth of Ham began to be a popular explanation for the origin of Africans. Genesis 9:20 to 27 tells the story of how about the family of Noah came out of the ark, and that Noah levied a curse upon the son of Ham, who was named Canaan. The story goes that at some point Noah planted a vineyard and became drunk from the wine of its grapes. the text states that he lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers, Shem and Japheth, about it. The text implies that Ham's treatment of his father's drunken nakedness was not respectful, whereas his brothers Shem and Japheth walked into the tent backward and covered their father's nakedness without gazing upon it. When Noah awoke, he was incensed and cursed Ham's son Canaan. Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. Genesis 9:25, American Standard Version. Other translations use the word slave as opposed to servant, and both translations are legitimate from the original Hebrew. In the 3rd century CE, Talmud scholars associated Noah's curse with idolatry and sexual immorality, not for turning Canaan black. However, at some point during the transatlantic slave trade, the curse on Canaan became associated with the belief in the innate inferiority of Africans and the justification for their enslavement. The idea was popularized in the 19th century. One work that had great significance was entitled The Biblical Defense of Slavery, written by Josiah Priest and published in 1853. Now, Priest was not a biologist, naturalist, or theologian, but he claimed that Africans were the cursed descendants of Ham, and thus slavery was divinely sanctioned. Another special creationist defense of slavery that became popular in this same time period was that of polygenism. Polygenism began in the 16th century as an attempt to solve the origin of non-European people. This, the polygenists thought, would be explained by the origin of Cain's wife. The Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain lay with his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch, Genesis 4, 16 through 17. Now, polygenism solved the mystery of the origin of the people residing in Nod by arguing that they resulted from different acts of creation. They were thus pre-Adamite people. The Swiss-born naturalist Louis Agassiz authored a theory that God had produced multiple zones of creation, each with its own plants, animals, and unique humans. Europeans were the descendants of Adam and Eve, while the dark-skinned races of the world were the result of different acts of creation. The physician Samuel Morton, who was an Episcopalian, ascribed to this theory. Morton maintained one of the largest collections of human skulls at the University of Pennsylvania. He measured their cranial capacity by use of bird seed and lead shot, and with these measurements, he was convinced that Europeans were the most perfect race due to their greater skull capacity compared to Malays, Amerindians, Asians, and Africans. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Roger Taney, relied on the reasoning of Agassiz and Morton when he declared in 1857 that Dred Scott had, quote, no rights that a white man was bound to respect, and that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery. In his decision against Scott's claim to freedom, he stated that Scott was no different from any other form of property. Now, Frederick Douglass rebuked the claims of the polygenists in an address entitled The Claims Against the Negro Ethnologically Considered, delivered at Western College Reserve in July of 1854. He disputed Morton's claims about the racial identity of the Egyptians, whom Morton claimed were white. Douglass showed that Egypt had been a multiracial society without the skin color prejudice of the 19th century. He assailed the polygenist methods as well. Quote, if a phrenologist or naturalist undertakes to represent portraits, the differences between the two races, the Negro and the European, he will invariably present the highest type of European and the lowest type of Negro. And here he was referring to the plates in Knott and Glidden's Races of Mankind, in which a European was identified with the bust of Apollo Belvedere, and an African was drawn as a chimpanzee. Now, scientific support for polygenism eroded in the 19th century after the publication of On the Descent of Man and Selection on the Basis of Sex by Charles Darwin in 1871. Contrary to popular belief, Darwin did not discuss human beings in The Origin of Species, published in 1859. And he did this not just to avoid conflict with the clergy, but he wanted to steer clear of the leading polygenist of the day, Louis Agassiz. Now, the subsequent development of biology in the 20th century demonstrated that all living things shared common descent, including humans. Indeed, much of the special creationist rancor against teaching human evolution in the 1920s was due to its logical necessity of the shared ancestry of all humans, eroding the idea of the innate superiority of Europeans over other humans. In 1942, the British anthropologist Ashley Montague published Mankind's Most Dangerous Myth, The Fallacy of Race. After the horrible logic of racial thinking was laid bare by the Nazi genocide of World War II, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, published its race statements of 1950 and 1951, authored by a blue ribbon panel of the world's leading scientists, further outlining the scientific arguments against racial classification and racial bigotry. Now, despite these publications, views of the innate and biblically inscribed inferiority of Africans persisted in American society. Undermining these false beliefs were critical to advancing civil rights for all. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. understood this. In Letter from Birmingham Jail, published in 1963, he directly confronted the dehumanizing effects of segregation. Segregation gives the segregator a false sense of superiority and the segregated a false sense of inferiority. In The American Dream speech, published in 1964, he argued for the inherent dignity and worth of all human beings and challenged the notion of Negro inferiority by outlining their contributions to American society. Finally, most of you remember his words from the I Have a Dream speech delivered at the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Unfortunately, we do not live in that society yet. Many would argue, as I do, that the last presidential election was determined by the color of the candidate's skin, as a person who won had failed in virtually every measurement of character you could conceive of. Now, our failure to achieve King's dream resides in the fact that while Christian denominations reject racism in theory, they do not in practice. This can be seen in the variety of ways that exist in our congregations to understand the origin of human biological diversity. For example, of mainline Protestants, of which Episcopalians are considered, 16% of the US population, 28% feel that human races evolved naturally. Okay. I think I've got this backwards. This will only take a second. Here we go. 31% feel that human races evolved along God's plan. 30% feel that God created humans in their present form. Now, in contrast, evangelical Protestants, who make up 14% of the US population, 11% feel that human races evolved naturally. 25% feel that human races evolved along God's plan, and 57% feel that God created humans in their present form. I address these disparate views of human origins in my 2023 essay entitled Out of Africa, Where Faith, Race, and Science Collide. Now, before I go on, I want to make the point that I do not believe that God is a trickster. The evidence of nature is not planted there to test our faith. The Bible was never designed to be a textbook of natural science. This is why I can adhere to my faith and still conduct rigorous examination of the way the universe and its components operate. Now, in that regard, the science of human evolution shows the following facts. One, our species is approximately 300,000 years old. Life on this planet is 3.5 billion years old. To place this scale in context, if we condense the history of life on Earth into a calendar year, we arrive on December 31st at 2 minutes to midnight. Now, all living humans on this planet are descended from the first humans who evolved in Africa and who we know were dark-complected. Three, our species stayed in Africa for 200,000 years before anyone left for other regions of the world. Four, all the essential aspects of being human existed in our species long before anyone left Africa. Five, the first humans who settled in Europe approximately 45,000 years ago were dark-complected. Traits such as fair skin and blonde hair are less than 10,000 years old. Six, very little genetic adaptation occurred during ancient human migration. Any two humans chosen at random from any two points on the planet share 99.4 to 99.9% of their genetic material in common. Now, my research group has shown that the acceptance of the details of human evolution also varies by socially defined race. In a large national survey, we found that 67.3, 60.9, and 53.8% of whites, Hispanics, and blacks, respectively, disagreed with the overwhelming evidence demonstrating that our species first evolved in Africa. The disagreement with this evidence was also strongly associated with the degree to which a respondent considered themselves religious. Yet, the science provides us with a powerful message about the nature of our neighbors. Despite our differences in physical appearance, we are all essentially the same organism underneath. We have the same capacities to choose good or evil. Thus, all our neighbors are at the same time our siblings. Thus, when Christ told us to love our neighbors, he was at the same time telling us to love our siblings. Now, everyone who's ever grown up with immediate brothers and sisters knows that this is no easy task, but we manage it. This is why Jesus told us that this was the second great commandment. We cannot separate the love of God from the love of our neighbors. We must do better, for this is the core of the Christian mission. Amen.